understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
Welcome to Second Captain Saturday, and thank you for all the John King love that came our way after last week's episode. Hey, Murph.
Hey, Owen, how's it going?
The widespread feeling was that CNN and Conor Mara's John King passed the crucial would I like to go for a pint with that person test. Unfortunately, his failure to land top spot on our leaderboard has completely undermined his confidence in himself as a broadcaster in the week of the Democratic Convention at a crucial time for the future of democracy itself. I just hope you can sleep at night, Murph. That's all I'll say.
You know what? I think he's going to be fine. I did turn on a bit of CNN this week. There is a lot of extremely confident broadcasters here. You know what? Funny enough, I didn't see John King. They were probably saving him for prime time, let's be honest. But I'm sure he's doing just fine.
Our next challenger is the wonderful writer Jan Carson, who grew up in Ballymena in the 1980s and 90s in a strict evangelical Protestant community. She gradually came to question the beliefs she'd grown up with. She's a really fascinating background. 2 years ago, she wrote a book. She shone a light on that world in her novel The Raptures, which was shortlisted for the On Post Irish Novel of the Year.
Yeah, it's so beautifully written, The Raptures. I bought it within a couple of months of it coming out, and it's just so good. And rereading it again this week in advance of talking to Jan, like, the thought that comes to me is that this is a world that exists on this island, but it's a world which so many of us have so little understanding of. There are Catholics and there are Protestants in the north. But it's important to note that the type of community that Jan is writing about, the type of community that Jan grew up in, is a different world again. And we're just incredibly lucky that we've a writer of the skill and talent of Jan to walk us through it. So I'm super excited about chatting to her in a few minutes.
Yeah, it's funny. There are echoes of a previous guest from the series, Mowgli Bapp. Kneecap, obviously coming from a very different
but
not geographically a million miles away, you know, but a very different background. But it's just that Jan is also part of a new generation of writers and artists making their name after the Troubles, who are dealing with the complexities of the North in fresh and really interesting ways. Mowgli Bapp, of course, among the contestants that she's chasing down in our greatest non-sportsperson sportsperson competition 2024.
Could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
In golf, they call it a wire-to-wire win, when you lead after the first day and then hold on for the whole tournament. Well, Brendan Gleeson is no one's idea of a PGA Tour professional, but that's what he's looking increasingly likely to do this summer. He was our first guest 5 weeks ago today. He still leads on 83 points in our race to find out our greatest non-sportsperson sportsperson for 2024. Remember, my task today is to assess Jan's all-time sporting highlight, choose a sportsperson that I feel most closely resembles her, and then, having weighed up her sporting achievements, give her a point score out of 100. It's a tough job, but I'm as tough as old boots on, and I'm up to the task.
Email editor at secondcaptains.com. Tweet us at secondcaptains. Jan Carson in studio next on Second Captain Saturday. That was Palaces of Montezuma by Nick Cave's Grinderman on Second Captain Saturday. Our guest today is part of a wave of incredible writing talent that's emerged from Northern Ireland in the last decade. A winner of the EU Prize for Literature, she's one of the most prolific writers in the business, publishing 8 books since her debut in 2014. Her brilliant novel, The Raptures, describes what life was like growing up in an evangelical community in the north, leaning heavily on her own childhood. A childhood where she dreamed she might one day follow in the footsteps of her all-time hero, the legendary BBC sports broadcaster, Jackie Fullerton. Jan Carson, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You can confirm your sporting highlight later. We'll get into detail, but it will feature the great Jackie Fullerton. You can say
absolutely,
this for
now. Absolutely, definitely.
Okay. Wow. I mean,
that's big.
Well, it's huge, John. Surely everyone knows who Jackie Fullerton is. But if there's anyone out there still labouring in a non-Jackie Fullerton world, he was a consummate television presenter. He was also an extremely sensuous, extremely erotic presence.
Well, lustrous hair
on BBC Northern Ireland. I mean, we remember him coming on immediately after the Vidi printer on Grandstand on BBC television every Saturday evening. the jewellery, of course, his good-natured bewilderment while trying to read out GA scores, the bouffant hairstyle, as you've mentioned. Oh, the man was a king. So this is very exciting.
We'll get to Jackie. We are getting at an exciting time, Jan. You're just about to head off on a fairly extensive US tour.
I am, yeah. I've got, I think, 8 or 9 states today in 3 weeks. So, yeah, I'll have to be putting my roller skates on to get around.
And you're deep into the editing stage on a new book, which has a fascinating hook you might be able to tell us about.
Yeah, I'm writing a kind of alternative history to the kind of little known story of future Prime Minister of Northern Ireland, Terence O'Neill, in 1958, proposed to Drian Lochnae and turn it into the 7th county of Northern Ireland.
This is a wind-up, surely.
No. Understandably, he was laughed out of Westminster proposing that, but I have imagined what might happen if he had gone ahead with what I'm calling the Nay Drainage Scheme. And as I began to explore that, I discovered there's actually an archipelago of little islands under the surface of the loch, for real.
Right.
And those would begin to emerge as soon as you drop the water level.
Why did he want to drain Lochnae, as a matter of interest?
So it's kind of interesting. He wanted to build a commuter town that would be equidistant between Derry and Belfast in the middle of Lochnae. For some reason, seemed the obvious place to do this. And as some people will know, he did get his commuter town in Craigavon later on. And I think he also had in the back of his mind some of those like FDR's back to work program in the States. And it's not beyond the realms of possibility. Lochnae has been partially drained 3 times in the past. So the Victorians built dams to try and create extra farmland around the edge. So when you start to look at it, it's not as ludicrous as it sounds, but still a great story.
Great story. There's a quote here from him around the time. County Nay would have no mountains or bogs and might be quite fertile. It could be planted with trees and people, and a new town could be built at its centre. Then in brackets, Strangford is smaller and has salt water and tide, but could perhaps also be considered.
The man was just he just wanted to drain everything.
Oh, he's a very interesting man. The more you look at his life, the more I read his autobiography last year, and it's a really good example of what we in literature called an unreliable narrator. I think Terence O'Neill's idea of himself didn't always line up with the reality.
In what way?
There's some lovely lines about how he was, you know, equally beloved by both sides of the community.
Yeah.
And you're sort of like, where are you, Terence?
The twist you put on this idea sounds, could you expand on that a little bit more? So you found out that there is this
archipelago, which is a word I've had to learn how to pronounce quite carefully.
And what have you done with that?
So I have the kind of drainage system happening through like the 60s and into the end of the 60s when the Troubles begins in earnest. And this archipelago of islands becomes a kind of sanctuary space for those who feel persecuted on what I've called mainland Northern Ireland. So the book is following the kind of story of the social anthropologist who is sent out to kind of keep a record of what's happening on these islands with this utopian community that has flourished there. So we see the kind of development of it, and we also see it now in post-Brexit Northern Ireland when there is only a handful of people left and they want to flood the loch again and get rid of I call it the archipelago, which is lovely imagery, floods and arcs and ends of the world and all sorts of things.
That sounds amazing. What stage are you at the moment?
At the pulling your hair out and wondering if it's ever going to actually come together stage.
Nice to have a chat about this if it doesn't ever come to life.
Yeah.
That sounds like the most fun stage, is it?
No, it's not. It's the stage where you've already taken the advance and you know you have to get it over the line. So no, it's finished. It's just in kind of edits and moving things around, and it will be simultaneously published in the US and the UK, Ireland, and that editorial process, sometimes there are tweaks and changes for an American market who might not be as familiar with the story here. So you've always got the two sort of edits running simultaneously in your head.
Yeah.
You keep coming back to Northern Ireland, Jan. What is it that makes it such a rich source of ideas for your writing?
I think it's just such a weird place. You know, when you hear...
Said with love.
Yeah, with absolute love. I've just been reading James Baldwin on the bus, and he talks about, you know, he's often accused at times of not being properly patriotic about America. And he says, no, I love America so much that I reserve the right to critique it. And I think that's very similar to how I would feel about the North. It's the best place in the world to live. I mean, I'm in Dublin right now. You lot are grand, but the folks in Belfast are just the warmest, funniest, most talented, kindest. But it's not without its absurdism. There's days when you feel like you're living in a Samuel Beckett play, you know, when Stormont's collapsed for the third or fourth time. So really rich pickings in terms of what to write about.
You come from an evangelical Protestant family. What did that mean for you as a kid?
Gosh, have you got 4 hours? So I'm from a kind of mixed family of my mum's family are Brethren. So folks are probably more familiar with Plymouth Brethren, but it's quite a strict traditional branch of evangelical Protestantism. And she married into quite strict Presbyterianism with my father. And it was a rural brand of that. So quite a lot of separatism. I grew up in Ballymena in the 1980s, and that was Paisley's site and a real kind of Paisley stronghold. So I always joke about there used to be a big sign on the roundabout as you come into Ballymena. It said, Ballymena still says no. And I thought we were saying no to line dancing because so much of what I was exposed to is all of the ways that you weren't allowed to enjoy yourself. No cinema, no dancing, no drinking, definitely no sex. So it felt like a quite a restrictive space, and yet also a space characterised by real safety. And I feel like that safety, that community, that feeling of being known and loved was no small thing at the height of the Troubles. So you balance those two things of, it wasn't an easy childhood, but I'm also grateful for the way I grew up as well.
Could you understand, or was there any rationale given to you as a kid for all these fun things basically being forbidden?
I think it's really hard to explain now, especially to I've got teenage nieces and nephews who are on their phones all the time, very aware of what's going on with youth culture around the world. This was before the internet, before mobile phones, where biggest exciting thing was going down to get a copy of Smash Hits smuggled out of Aisens on a Thursday night. So I think there was such a subculture of evangelical Protestantism in Ballymena. We had youth clubs, we had Girls Brigade, Boys Brigade, Scouts and Brownies and Sunday School and Bible camps. And there was a whole subculture of stuff where you didn't really understand what you were missing out on.
Was there a fear of the outside world instilled in kids? Or as you describe it there, did you just not think about what was going on outside your own small bubble?
I wouldn't say fear. I think the fear kind of set in for me after I became aware of people who were different from us when I went to university and I, you know, met my first Catholic and made my first Catholic friend. And then I realised that what an unknown world that was. I mean, I didn't have my first drink until I was 21 because I was so afraid of the, you know, pub environment. And, you know, if you've never been taught how to order at a bar, it's quite a terrifying process, the noise of it and everything. Growing up, it was just more a sense of othering. You know, we knew where the kind of Catholic areas of the town were. We knew that some people got different buses to school, that they dressed differently, that they had different names from us. And I guess for me, you know, being so steeped in literature, it was quite fascinating. Mm. You know, anything that's other, I was quite intrigued by what was going on in there.
Was there any room for you to question what you were being taught?
For me, the outlet was literature. So when I was growing up, the two big grocery stores in the north were Sturt's and Crazy Prices. And Sturt's was right beside the library, and that was where we got our groceries. So my mum would leave me while she got the groceries on a Wednesday night in the library in Ballymena. Mm-hmm. And I very quickly read through all the kids' books and made my way to crime fiction. I think it was about 8 when I read my first Agatha Christie. And that was a window into the world. I mean, I also will say that someday in Ballymena Library filed Martin Amis's The Rachel Papers in the children's section. Well, so I also read that at 8, and that was a massive eye-opener.
I think I read that at, 38, and that was a bit of an eye-opener for me too, to be honest. So, yeah.
I tracked down, there's a 1980s copy of it with bubble writing on the front that some librarian must have just been like, oh, this is like Sweet Valley High, yeah. I'll just pop it in here.
Music as well. The Suede album cover in particular.
Yeah.
You feared might be problematic.
Yeah. You know, music was a big outlet for me in my kind of mid-teens. I'd fallen in with some friends in school that were really into Britpop. And I was allowed to buy the records, but I would have to change the explicit lyrics signs around and everything so they couldn't be seen, and would stay up late at night to listen to the evening sessions with my finger hovering over the record button to tape songs. I think it's a very familiar. A lot of us didn't have the first bit of the song or the last bit of the song for a very long time.
You mentioned earlier that there were, this is a warm, loving community as well, and there seemed to be people in it that inspired you, particularly your principal of your primary school.
Yeah, I was really lucky in that I went to a small, it would have been a country primary school then. Now the town has expanded and it isn't anymore, but it was very small. And Dr. Simpson, our principal, was really, really ahead of his time. Really wonderful man who brought classical music into the school. He had a full orchestra in black ties and everything. He taught us about art and nature. And for me, that was one of the only outlets that I got into this kind of slightly more highbrow world of art and ideas. The other big influence would have been Inspector Morse. My dad was a big lover of watching like crime on TV. And I remember he was getting something out of Inspector Morse, and I was getting, gosh, you know, here's John Thaw talking about Shakespeare or Wagner or what's going on there?
So you, Jan, had these books and music flooding into your life at this stage. Did cracks then start appearing in your faith, in what you had been brought up to believe?
Yeah, I mean, I would make a big distinguishment, not sure if that's the right word. I would distinguish between faith and religion. I would say I probably still have a degree of faith. To me, faith is something that's open-ended and has room for question and inclusion, and religion feels like a much tighter thing. And that's what began to crack and be questioned, that I couldn't reconcile these kind of ethereal revelations and moments that I was having with the very kind of hellfire and brimstone brand of religion we were getting from the pulpit. And then I also couldn't reconcile it with the Bible, because I would open the Bible and be like, it's full of parables and stories and poetry. Like, what's going on here? So there were a lot of questions starting to creep in.
Would you have said that you rebelled from it, or was it just a very gradual sort of distancing yourself from that? Because it doesn't really sound like, for all the kind of suede albums or Britpop albums and all the rest, you weren't kicking up a fuss about it. You were eager to hide, still hide that from your parents and enjoy it on your...
Yeah, and I think, I mean, that my parents weren't overly strict. It was more the institution within which they worked, that, you know, there wasn't room to be an artist there. Like, you know, I never had a roaring argument with my parents over what I was listening to or anything like that. And I think this is a question beyond religion for a lot of folks of our generation. I'm just going to look at you two and assume you're about the same age as me. You know, maybe the first people in the family to go to university, you go off and you come back with your parents' blessing, but they expect you to, you know, build a bungalow and move down the road. And what you come back from university with is thoughts and ideas and notions, we would say in the north, that don't fit in with your parents. And suddenly there's like that gap between, you know, how do I communicate with people that I love who haven't had the same experience of the world around them? So something I think a lot of us are negotiating in different ways.
One way you negotiated that was to write a book about it, which isn't what everybody would do, I would say, Jan.
Aye, but it took me 10 years to write that book.
How do you mean it took you 10 years?
Like, the first incarnation, that was the first book that I sat to write down, The Raptures. It wasn't called The Raptures back then, but when I first started writing, 2005, 2006, that was, you know, writers will say they have a book in them. That was the book that was in me. And at that stage, it was an angry book and it was a judgy book. And it was a book that I'm pretty glad I didn't put out into the world at that point. So it took me 10 years of kind of growing into my voice as a writer, but also growing into myself as how do I navigate who I am and be able to be grateful as well as critical.
How did that change then from the angry book that was in your head 10 years previously to what you actually ended up coming up with, which is much more nuanced and less, as you said, they're judgy?
I think a lot of writing, to be honest. So I'd moved to the States when I was 25 in 2005, and that's where I first started writing. And I had no intention of coming home. I was living in Portland, Oregon, having the time of my life. And then my work visa ran out, and I came back absolutely under duress. And it was the writing that made me fall in love with Northern Ireland. You know, to write something well, you have to pay close attention to it. And to pay close attention to it, you begin to see the cracks. And I have a bit in the Last Resort, which is a short story collection I have, where a guy says, look, some people can see the cracks in everyone. And when you see that, you have the choice whether to use that knowledge to pull someone apart or to hold them together. And there's a power in both things. And I feel that as a writer, that I wanted to hold things together. So to be able to acknowledge the faults, but also to do that with love and to do it with grace too.
There's a lot of responsibility on your shoulders in that scenario though.
Yeah, but I think someone's got to start these conversations. You know, there's been a lot of talk about kind of how the Catholic Church has impacted, and the artists were very much at the front line of that, asking big questions and making challenges. And there's not been as much of that done with this evangelical Protestant world. And yet when you look at the kind of influence that people like Paisley, who was an ordained clergy as well as a politician, there are questions to be asked and stories still to be told.
The questions you raise there that you feel weren't being asked around the community you come from, do you feel fiction is a vehicle to ask those sorts of big questions?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, and it's something I've been thinking about a lot recently. I've been looking at particularly female writers of the kind of 40s, 50s, 60s, like Agatha Christie and Barbara Pym and Elizabeth Taylor, who all of whom had traumatic things happen in their own lives, and yet you chose to work that out through the lens of fiction rather than talk about it directly. Mm. And to me, there's a safety there. Like, we're living in a kind of literary moment where it's very, very trendy to, you know, shout about all of the difficult, terrible, awful things that have happened to people. And that can be amazing if you're in a mature spot where you're ready to deal with it. Can give other people confidence to come forward. If there's not support mechanisms in place, if you are not in a space where you're not going to re-traumatise yourself, fiction can be a fantastic alternative to just use metaphor, share a little bit of your story, work things out in a way that feels safe and boundaried.
Did you come to a better or even a different understanding of your childhood through the writing of The Raptures?
Yeah. Absolutely. And the talking about it afterwards as well. Like, when you write a book like that and put it out in the world, folks come forward with their own stories. And that felt both quite a heavy thing to sit under for a while, but also a real privilege and a learning curve. Like, I've had many, many people come up after readings in tears because they've had bad experiences or hard experiences. And I've also had lots of people come up and say, I'm so grateful for this book. It's opened a conversation between me and my parents, or me and my faith community. And I mean, gorgeous stuff. Like, it's translated into French. And in France, the big conversation has been with young Muslim women.
Right.
And they are walking that journey of respect for their parents, but also reconciling their faith with contemporary life and being a modern woman. And what does that mean?
Well, what about your own parents then? I know your dad died a few months before the book came out. What was your relationship like with him as you got older and started to question the things that he had raised you to believe in? It seems like it stayed really strong anyway.
Yeah, I think my daddy was on a journey as well. I think particularly from, he died towards the end of COVID and had been ill for a lot of it. And for him, he was thinking through and just asking big questions about some of the doctrines that he'd grown up with. And it's one of the biggest regrets in my life that he didn't live to have further conversations, because I really think he was on a trajectory towards, you know, being a wee bit more open-minded about things.
Did you have those conversations with him? You reference at one point talking around the edges of big things, which I think is how, to be honest, a lot of us talk about the bigger stuff in life.
I mean, my last but one conversation I had with Daddy, I told him a little bit about the Raptures and how it might be hard for him. I can still see him sitting on the sofa, and he looked at me and said, do you know what, Jana, you need to stop worrying and just write the book you need to write. And that felt like a real blessing. And I have held on to that very much. But I am. I'm just a bit sad that we couldn't have had more conversations like that.
That's a beautiful memory to have, though.
Yeah. I mean, my last memory is eating a fish supper with him, and that was a pretty good memory too.
You're listening to the brilliant writer Jan Carson, who might have made her name as a football commentator if things had fallen a little bit differently. More on that after the break.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
This is Second Captain Saturday with Owen and Murph. Jan Carson, author of The Raptures, is in studio despite a slight delay arriving down to us. Jan, there was an eventful bus journey.
It was, and we got stopped just over the border by the guards who came on and passported everyone and escorted three different individuals off the bus. So I've heard about this happening, but it's the first time it's actually happened to me.
It's been a bit of a shock.
Yeah, I mean, for anybody who grew up in the north, you know, before the peace agreement, we still have memories of what that was like to cross the border in the bad old days, and it just comes back very quickly. I was sitting there reading James Baldwin and afterwards thinking, would James Baldwin have sat through this, or would he have like stood up and protest? And it's also just, you know, it's very interesting how quickly you just go along with everybody else. No one else is questioning this. They're all merrily getting out their driving license and passports. Whereas I know I don't really have to. So yeah, it did. It felt a bit upsetting, and I still need to think about it a little bit more, I think.
No, it's fair enough. It's something to process, I think. When did you get your Irish passport?
I got my Irish passport in 2017, so to my shame, I am part of the post-Brexit generation.
Well, it leads me to ask the obvious follow-up, why did you get an Irish passport at that point in your life?
Well, a couple of things. So the obvious one is because I didn't want all the queues, and I was travelling around Europe quite a lot at that stage.
So a practical element for sure.
But it was also kind of the culmination of a process of thinking about national identity for me. I had, you know, been really, really well received and welcomed by the Irish writing community, much more so than I had by the British writing community. And, you know, that culminated in 2019 for me when the, you know, I got the EU Prize for Literature for Ireland for a book about loyalism, which felt like a really gracious gesture to me. So I would probably identify as an Irish writer for sure now.
Why do you think the Irish writing community has been more welcoming than the British?
Just because they're friendlier people. I mean, I think there's something about being on an island together. They're all knocking off each other, and like there's a huge festival kind of community here where you're seeing people almost every weekend. We're living in each other's pockets. There is, you know, the Irish Arts Council, not so much the Northern one, which is by far and away the worst in the UK at the minute, but the Irish one really values the arts and properly funds it. And there's a culture there of writing as a thing to be celebrated and supported, which maybe isn't as prevalent in the UK at the minute.
Is there a difference between being an Irish writer and an Irish person?
I think I'm living in that kind of like liminal space at the minute, and probably edging more towards feeling like an Irish person, simply because of the grace and the welcome that's been extended to me, and the natural curiosity, like people who really want to learn about the community I grew up in. But there are still some things about British identity that I love and value. I'm just back from Edinburgh Book Festival, and I've such strong connections with the Scottish writing community as well, and I would write with lots of Ulster Scots words, and there's links there with Scots Gaelic. And so to me, straddling the two kind of identities feels where I am at the minute and quite a comfortable space to be in.
You said before that you, when the Irish passport arrived in the post, you cried.
Yeah.
Was this out of happiness or some other emotion?
I think confusion. Just, I'm still, I think, the only person in my extended family that has an Irish passport. So there was just a sense of, you know, I'm not going to lie and pretend I'm not who I am. Like, my grandfather was in the Orange. My dad was Presbyterian clergy. There's a very strong link to not just Protestant culture, but probably Unionism as well. So, you know, to have an Irish passport is to begin to ask big questions about who you are and how you value your heritage and who you want to be. And that's a confusing kind of thing to navigate.
Did you worry at all that you're in some ways betraying that heritage by getting the Irish passport?
No, not at all. I'd been watching The Handmaid's Tale on TV at the same time, and there's that awful scene where the family is split up because somebody has a Canadian passport and everyone else has American ones. And I was like, oh no, my family's all going to get stuck at the border.
Was Irish culture then something in history, something you had to learn off your own bat?
Yeah, very much so. And I'm still learning and I feel very ignorant all the time. We didn't get any Irish history in school and certainly no Irish language or Irish mythology or even things like, you know, trad music or, you know, when you're in Europe, you always get asked, do you do the river dancing?
For a variety of reasons, we don't need to get into here. Yeah. That's not something.
So it has left me kind of at sixes and sevens sometimes in conversations. You know, Irish writers will come up that I haven't heard of, references in things like Heaney to Celtic mythology that I've no notion what's going on, but I'm trying to learn as quickly as I can.
You said a while back, Jan, I think we've got a brilliant and ballsy generation coming up in Northern Ireland, and they all grew up after the Good Friday Agreement. They don't want to write about the conflict. They want to write about gender and the environment. That, to me, shows a degree of recovery.
Yeah, I think that freedom to not always have to be dredging over history or picking apart the politics of the place shows me that, you know, there's room there to not just be from the north of Ireland, to be many, many things at once. But I think within that, there's also the, you know, we reserve the right to talk about our past, to question it, to talk about political decisions that are going on now. There's a whole mix of things going on. And there was a real like kind of catch-22 situation when I started writing where, you know, the publishing world were like, nobody wants to hear about Northern Ireland anymore. It's done. That ship has sailed. But also, you're not allowed to write about anything but Northern Ireland.
Right. Yeah.
And it's lovely to see writers that are coming out who are not writing about the North and writers who are choosing to write about the North. Mm. I mean, I always say like a wonderful thing happened for us around the kind of advent of Derry Girls, which was roughly the same time that Milkman won the Booker.
Yeah.
And I think the world sort of woke up and were like, we've never heard about the teenage girls' perspective on the conflict. What other perspectives have we not heard? And, you know, Paul McVeigh wrote The Good Son, which is a wonderful book about growing up gay in West Belfast during the conflict. Karina Docherty started to write about the environment in conflict. There are so many perspectives that have yet to be explored. And then that, you know, one person's experience of growing up gay in Northern Ireland will work alongside, you know, something like Damien Barr's experience of growing up gay in Glasgow, working class under Thatcher. So there are resonances there that become really interesting.
Jan, I want to start building up your points here. So let's do this because I can see this is the kind of thing that impresses Murph. Tell us how many books you read last year. I know it's not strictly a sporting endeavour, but give us an approximate number.
No, because then all the haters get on at me about you're not reading properly.
Don't mind the haters.
I have to say, it's my job to read. I read 4 hours a day. I read, I think, 312 books.
Ah, come on.
I actually now have worked out how to read on the treadmill at the gym. So,
are you serious?
Yeah, so I can combine sports and reading. Not walking very fast, but I can read and walk.
I'm sorry, what are the haters saying? You're not reading properly?
Yeah.
What, as in you're just skimming these books?
Yeah,
is that?
Like I'm not treating them with like due respect, but I do sit for 4 hours a day and read, and you know you can easily read a paperback in that time.
I'm a slower reader. Is this purely for the joy of reading, or because it kind of sounds like training for your writing at the same time?
Yeah, I mean, some of the stuff is actually my job that I'm reviewing or giving quotes or preparing for an interview or something. Some is pure pleasure. Every about 10th book I read Agatha Christie again because I just love her. And some is to learn. You know, I am reading this year all of Carson McCullers and all of James Baldwin, and that is such a learning curve.
What have you learned?
I've learned that I'm not a very good writer and I need to keep practicing.
No, keep you humble.
I think the biggest thing that I've learned is nobody arrives fully formed. In the same way, to make a sports kind of illusion, you don't arrive a fully formed sports person. You have to train. And I often think, I was talking to somebody about this last week, I spend hours and hours, maybe 12 hours a day at the minute, writing and editing. And if I was training to be an Olympic swimmer, nobody would bat an eyelid at that. Mm. It's just what you have to do. I think it's the same for the arts. If you want to get really good, you have to put the hard yards in.
Where did sport fit into your childhood?
Nicely. Nice segue there.
Segue?
This isn't his first rodeo, you know.
No. I was quite a serious hockey player. So I was goalkeeper for my team and I played for my county a few times as well.
Wow, all right.
And we had my hockey team in high school. I went to an all-girls Protestant grammar and we had a very, very tight defence and a not very exciting like load of forwards.
So a very dour
kind
of game
plan. It was very dull.
Yes,
being the goalie was a lot of time practicing my French verbs in my head. A lot of cold Saturday mornings. And then I also played netball for my school as well. And, you know, as you know, like the sports in the north is very segregated. Yeah. You know, you wouldn't have been playing Catholic schools at field hockey, but there was mixing and mingling in the netball league. And for me, that was a fascinating peek behind the scenes.
Oh, wow. How much of a peek did you get? How much of an insight just by playing sport?
I remember like being in the cafeteria having like, you know, your orange juice slices in your water at half time and being like, they've got really funny smelling cups in here. Is that a Catholic thing? And I think it just might have been the school, to be honest.
This does actually sound like that Dairy Girls scene where they're the Catholic and Protestant kids are listing
keep
the differences
toaster in the cupboard. Protestants keep the toaster in the cupboard.
We had this thing called EMU, Education for Mutual Understanding. And it is exactly what the Dairy Girls thing was. There was a point that it was very trendy to do. Do you know what nightlines are?
Nightlines.
It was like a rope line through a forest that you did at midnight when the dark, and it was like orienteering, but there was a rope.
Yeah, yeah.
So we went off at one stage with a Catholic group to find your way around a forest, and I still don't know how being tied to a Catholic to work around a forest was helping with the peace process.
Did it help anyway in your understanding of these Catholic kids? No.
No.
So did you approach this in any serious way, or were you just thinking, this is a bit barmy?
It just was, you knew it was a box-ticking exercise. And I think it wasn't until I got to university and start to make proper friendships and build proper community with folks in the other community that I realised that. To bring it back to the sports stuff, like my nephew and niece have come up through integrated education, and my nephew's big into basketball, and watching what basketball has done as a non-sectarian sport in the north is really gorgeous. You know, he's playing with a load of lads that he hasn't a clue what background they're from. They just love playing basketball on a Saturday morning.
Hockey goalkeeper, by the way. We can't just brush over that. That is, I know there's a lot of padding that you guys wear. That's a lethal position.
There's still a chip in my ankle bone that moves around funny because I was 5 years in before I realised I was putting the pads on the wrong legs. And those hockey balls are very hard if you take it right on the ankle.
We've hinted at your sporting highlight on more than one occasion, Jane. It involves Jackie Fullerton. We know this. So what exactly happened?
So in 1995, we had to do a school's career project, and my best friend decided to be a gladiator. that was frowned upon. I decided I was either going to be prime minister or I was going to be a football commentator for some reason.
Okay.
Wrote to Tony Blair and he wouldn't let me job shadow him, but Jackie Fullerton said yes.
Jackie Fullerton will always say yes in that scenario.
So I went round with my wee interview kit to his house, which he just lived up the road from us, and I still remember he had a white shag pile carpet and a really fancy glass coffee table.
That sounds so on brand.
You know, in my head he's still wearing the sheepskin jacket inside, but I don't think he was. My mum was like, don't put your feet on the floor. Because I'd walked there. So he was just very gracious and lovely. And, you know, as she's mentioned at the start, somebody who had been in my psyche as just part of my childhood for such a long time. Not just seeing him on the TV, but like seeing him in the spa at the end of the road buying his milk and being like, it's Jackie Fullerton on the TV.
Don't meet your heroes, they say. But this one went okay, did it?
It did. Now, I'm not a football commentator today, as you can possibly tell.
You let Jackie down there, let's be honest.
I did. I was going to be Northern Ireland's first female soccer commentator.
So what exactly inspired this desire to be a football Northern Ireland's first female football commentator?
I think, first of all, it was a way to bond with my brother and my dad. Like, they'd always, like, even from when my brother was like 2 years old, there was a World Cup year and my dad got this sticker book and collected it for him. I think it was really for my dad. So it was a way to bond with them. And I think now looking back, I love the talking. Like, I used to sit and watch the football with the sound off and try and do the, like, and he's doing this and this. And
you did that? You practiced the commentary?
Oh, yeah. I was very serious about it and got, you know, all of my football magazines every week. And I actually went from that straight into community radio. So I got a show on the community radio in Ballymena within a couple of years of that and began to realise it wasn't maybe the football I loved, it was the talking and the communicating. Yeah. Radio was still one of my favourite mediums. I love doing this kind of thing.
Well, we love having you on. I mean, you veered away from the football then at that point, by the sounds of it.
I did, yeah. I think maybe that's when I fell head into books and music. And great as sport is, like, you know, music is just a lot sexier.
Let's be honest.
No offense taken.
Yeah.
But listen, Murph, you've been busy totting up the points there. So I think you could now rank.
Sorry, I'm just blinded by all this.
Now, there's a lot, going on there.
A lot of new information.
Would you like
here,
I mean, you know, we are on live radio here.
No, I'm ready to go.
Could you please now rank this sporting life of Jan Carson?
You don't understand. I could have had class.
We don't have stars in this game, Mrs. Weaver.
What do you have then?
People like me.
I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
Well, Jan, it's been a delight today, but this radio show is not a participation sport. It's about winners and losers. And I will now assess your performance here today to decide if you are a winner or a loser. We've already outlined just why Jackie Fullerton is a very special person in our lives. You literally could not have paid homage to a more professional and devastatingly handsome sports journalism god. This highlights your exquisite taste in sports broadcasters. But now, you say you've read 312 books last year. But was one of those books, Jackie, I did it my way? I don't think it was in the 312 last year, so I do have to take that under advisement.
That's next year, the full Jackie Fullerton back catalogue.
Yeah. On the other hand, you did use netball as an excuse to flex your journalistic muscles and scout out how the other side lives. And intrepidness is always going to earn you points with this broadcaster. Between that, meeting Jackie... you have a dedication to sports reportage that puts me in mind of England goalador turned TV personality Gary Lineker. Your hockey goalkeeping heroics, that ecumenical netball. There's more than enough evidence from your school days to suggest you had the burning desire of a born winner. All in all, it's been an honour having you here with us today. You've got 78 points. Not good enough to overtake Brendan Gleeson, but you've given Kirsty Wark a thrashing here today that she won't soon forget. So, Jan Carson, this has been your sporting life.
Will you accept 78 points, Jan?
Yeah.
It's easy to put this man up if you want to just try to politely ask.
I don't think I'll ever catch up with Brendan Gleeson. So I'm happy with 78.
He's sailing away at number
one. He's unassailable at 83 points.
Jan, it has been an absolute pleasure. Listen, thanks so much. And best of luck in America as well. Hopefully it all goes well. A round of applause, please, for Jan Carson. Finish up with a bit of suede. Should we do some suede?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do it. That one is Trash by Suede, as endorsed by Jan Carson, our guest today on Second Captain Saturday. Just on the way out the door there, Jan informed us that some of her fellow gym goers didn't take too kindly initially to her reading a book while on the treadmill. It's not standard gym etiquette, but she was in there recently, has a look across, and someone else has followed her lead and has their book out. I know it's too late for additional points, Mert, but it is impressive that she's inspiring a treadmill reading revolution here.
I think so. Like, my wife has described TV series that she knows as kind of treadmill worthy, in that she would watch them on the treadmill, but she wouldn't actually sit down on her couch to watch them. She'd watch them on her treadmill on her phone. But I really think reading a book on the treadmill is a number of levels above watching, let's face it, probably pretty crappy Netflix shows while on the treadmill.
That was a really interesting experience Jan had on the way here. As she says, she's still processing it herself. The bus she was on being pulled over just over the border past Newry and guards checking people's IDs. We asked Angarda Síochána to clarify how frequent these checks on the border are. This is what they told us. Angarda Síochána carries out immigration checks along the border on a regular basis to detect breaches of immigration legislation and detect abuses of the common travel area. Checks are also conducted on the train line running through County Louth, with checks conducted in Dundalk as the first entry point into this jurisdiction from Northern Ireland. The Garda National Immigration Bureau has significant operational cooperation with the UK Border Force, UK Policing Services and the Police Service of Northern Ireland. All checks carried out are lawful, objective and respectful. That's pretty much it for this week. Only two guests remain to challenge Brendan Gleeson at the top of the leaderboard this series. We are back next Saturday at 1 o'clock. This has been a Second Captains production for RTE. Killian Down produced. Mark Horgan is the series producer for Second Captains. A big thanks to Johnny Lanigan in RTE. If you do have a minute at any stage, please check out secondcaptains.com for details of all of our shows from Monday to Friday. Thank you, Murph.
Thanks a million, Owen.
Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you next week.